Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island Beer Company, which brews beers that are highly rated by beer critics and beer lovers alike. More at gooseisland.com. We don't need to be the only beer you drink. We just want to be the best beer you drink.
Ooh, 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 ooh.
This is Sound Opinions, and today we welcome Esperanza Spalding to the show. What a story, Craig. This young woman was a child prodigy on the double bass, went to the prestigious Berklee College of Music, not only graduated from there, but became an instructor. Debut album, 2006, began playing with heavyweights like Wayne Shorter, Prince, Herbie Hancock, won the Best New Artist Grammy in 2011, primarily known as a jazz musician. But she's always worked across genre boundaries, and on her latest album, Emily's D+ Evolution, there is funk, there is jazz, there is classical, there is progressive rock.
She absolutely has a long list of talents, Jim. I mean, this new album is so theatrical. It crosses so many genre boundaries, artistic boundaries, because it seeps into theater and dance, and you could really see that come to the fore in her stage show. I mean, she's a multi-instrumentalist, a multilingual vocalist, a band leader, a librettist, a songwriter, a soloist. She's a teacher. The list goes on and on. So I asked her how she identifies herself and what she likes to do the most.
What I like to do most is apparently think of something that I don't know how to do yet and then throw all the ingredients that I can think of up under the canvas and see what sticks and figure out how to make it work. Sometimes that involves bass playing, sometimes that involves singing, sometimes that involves like theater. I like to experiment and create things that first were up here in the old imaginative mind. And I really like to bring things to life.
Well, you covered all of that ground in the new album, Emily's D+ Evolution, not only in the album itself, but in the performances that have set it up. Everything that I've seen, there's a theatrical element to it. There's dancing as well as all this other stuff.
Thank so you're you for getting calling it dancing.
You're getting into all these other areas as well. There's a character involved that you're seeing the world through, Emily. Explain how you arrived at the point where you created what I guess might be an alter ego for you.
Initially, Emily was born in 2013 in October. And I don't like to use the word alter ego because I really experience her like a character that's coming for this one project and this one mission. She's coming to talk about something for a period and really like bust open a channel. For me, but of course on the stage, that's the main premise of the story. She's here to look at things with fresh eyes and experiment and encourage folks to erupt and discover what's been hidden under the surface. So I didn't know when she first came why Emily needed to be here. I saw this character and it was really intriguing to me. And I heard like this sound image of the musical style. It was really energetic. I knew there was going to be movement in the performance. I was seeing these quote-unquote songs. They weren't songs yet, but these sort of song subjects playing in my mind as little vignettes. And I thought, whoa, yeah, that's what I want to do. That vision, quote-unquote, came to me in the middle of a hiatus. So I wasn't doing anything as a band leader. I had left my management, my agent, my label. And I thought I was just chilling. I thought I was going to just be a side person until further notice.
Take a little girl who gets to see her mama broke down. Now she's a lady made for the modern world, my life. But if you ask my advice, there's raging bears, a China dolls fed up with bloody follows. All the way down, digging up holy scriptures to shame her while she drowns. But if you ask my advice, that shallow pits a bargain next to judgment day. It's only a matter of time, honey. Good money sinks through her teeth. She's not evil.
Emily was your middle name, right?
It is my middle name,
It was Esperanza Emily Spalding. So how much Esperanza's in Emily and how much Emily's in Esperanza?
Well, that what you just said of Emily being my middle name is the perfect allegory for what she is. it's something that's in the middle that hasn't been used. Mm. So when I think of Emily's in the middle, I think like Emily is within. She's inside. It really feels like there was this creative force and creative curiosity that I wasn't exploring. I didn't know that, like I said, when Emily was born, but now I understand that Emily was like, hey, you need to play more. Like, there's other things that we need to do out here that you need to do, like move, act, dance. Stop being so serious, you know? Stop trying so hard to like show that you know what you're doing. And I've understood now, I had a lot of hangups about needing to prove that I could really play because I felt like so many people saw me as just like a pretty lady that was lucky. And I felt, I think all through my 20s, even before anybody knew who I was, that I had to show that I was a real musician and that I was here for this music and that I could play bass and that I wasn't just messing around. And I think part of Emily coming was like, F that.
Right.
Mm. You know you can play. If other people can't see that, that's their problem. You know why you do the music. That's not going to go away. Like, do what you want to do. Play how you want to play. Like, I was hearing and imagining and thinking more than I was allowing myself space to explore.
Yeah.
And part of the urgency to me of doing this project with all its challenges and ups and downs is I think a lot of artists, a lot of humans struggle with that. You struggle with trying to break through other people's projections on you that you feel like first you have to prove wrong before you can do anything else. Like you have to earn the right to just go do your thing. And that is false.
There are no perfect amends here. You get to just keep on getting there, getting there. There's no promise or test here.
A voracious music lover. I know.
Correct.
You listen across genres and across eras. Are there other performers, musicians, who have channeled characters that you took inspiration from for Emily? Like, you know, whether it's David Bowie and Peter Gabriel or Tori Amos and Lady Gaga. You know, I mean, I wonder, you know, how much of that was in your thinking in creating this character?
Well, I became aware, I suppose, of character and theater and dramaturgy as like a resource for performance. Because throughout 2013 and a little bit in 2012, I started to get into libretto writing. Mm. And so I started to look at music performance that involved character and storyline. Huh. And then I started to look into more theater work and I started realizing like, whoa, dramaturgy, like acting, huh. I wasn't looking for the resources to fuel Emily, but rather, the idea of her being a character, I think, grew out of the osmosis of just checking out on YouTube all this theater stuff. Then there was a place to run and look when Emily came to the forefront as a character I was going to play. I'd never done anything like that before.
But what were you YouTubing?
Well, I kind of tripped out when I discovered Samuel Beckett.
One must laugh at these things, Meg. Why do you always laugh at them? Shh, not so loud. Nothing is funnier than unhappiness, I grant you that. Oh, yes. Yes, it's the most comical thing in the world.
There's a poet, an author slash poet called Ruth Krauss, and she had written a bunch of poem plays, which are these, like, quote-unquote, unstageable poem plays. They're really, they could be poems, but they're written to be staged. And I felt like the room that she leaves for the reader's imagination is so generous. And I really resonated with that mode of performance. And it was really fun to read the director's interpretation of how they would stage it. It'd be something like 300 people walk into a station, 500 trees appear, the station exits, you know.
Right.
It's hard to stage, but it leaves a lot of room for obviously directorial interpretation. And as the viewer or as the reader, you're, as I'm sure just happened in your brain, like it lands and your creative mind goes, whoa, And it's, I love it. That's intriguing to me. And there's a piece of that, what just happened in your minds when I quoted that, which was an indirect quote, just for the record, that I think improvisation does, like jazz improvisation does. You hear something get set up and you don't know where it's going to go. And when you hear like the melodic poetic conclusion, it's like, oh, your brain does the counterpoint and the math and you hear the full phrase. And I felt connected in theater. I felt the connection from dramaturgy, from what I've been doing in jazz. And honestly, I feel much more satisfied incorporating the improv of music and the improv of staging and acting than I was just being a bass player. And I didn't realize there was something missing. And once I realized that there was, I said, okay, well, here we go, guys. It's time to look like a fool for a couple years and figure this out.
Ochre, ivy, brick, and leather bound books built up by heavy like crooks with unburdened minds of bastardized Darwinian logic projected as art evidence on backs and faces of our ancestral culprits wasted toiling as a majority on plantated crimes. We want to knock and climb brass rings of wisdoms and build our own hot breath kingdoms and make fuming passions rain down ash and hand out dirty white rules to wipe up and memorize and howl our own law hand-me-downs upon the class of masses and grin as each graduate passes on our synthesized words that sterilize natural awe.
I just want to ask a couple more things about the record because it's a fascinating record. It's
Thank you.
Dense. The songwriting is a major leap for you, I think.
Thank you.
And I'm thinking about that track, Ebony and Ivy. And at first, I misread it as Ebony and Ivory. And I go, is she covering that really not so good
idea.
Song?
Yeah.
But then I realized it's the book by this historian, Craig Stephen Wilder, about how the slave trade was actually, some American universities were benefiting greatly
Absolutely.
From it. And you're diving deep into this very dense piece of music as well as lyrics into this subject. And it seems like that's, to me, the big leap here in this record is that these lyrics are really, not that you weren't saying anything before, but you're really sending across some powerful messages in what you wanted to write here. Why specifically that book and in that track? Why did you choose to include it in this record?
Well, I had picked up this phenomenon of from myself, from my own personal experience and friends that I grew up with, where we, say me and people who've gone through this, feel like we have to have our intelligence verified by an academic institution. Like we don't trust our own experience and our own experiential intelligence from living a life in this culture, in this world. And once you subject yourself, I would say, to like institutionalized intelligence verification, it's really hard to make it through without assuming the ideology of that institution. And remember, the institution, for instance, let's say one of these Ivy League schools whose founders and presidents were receiving money and funding from slaveholding families, were producing material to justify the behavior, the slave trade that was funding their institution. To a big degree, I think we still defer our sense of value to these institutions, and a lot of the ideology within is very classist, and woven into the system is a philosophy that says, yeah, if we can't prove that you're intelligent, you're really not. Mm-hmm. And I really don't think that's fair. So that song initially wasn't speaking to, you know, the history of slave trade being involved with Ivy League schools and their perpetuation. It really was about how disenfranchised people believe that they'll be justified and their value will be proven if they can just make it through the system and get that degree on their back to say, like, I'm somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And the question in that song is, so then what? Now what do you do with that?
Right.
Do we really know why we're pursuing that?
Mm-hmm.
The simple answer may just be, I just wanted somebody else to affirm that I'm good enough, you know?
Right.
Imagine how many versions of brilliance are squashed and squandered. Because that the institution teaches you that you're not worth anything unless you can prove it in that model.
It's been hard to lose sight, growing good and act happy, and pretend that the Ivy Bands didn't weigh our friends down. It's been hard to cross sight, but we're finally happy when the sage on the mountain now is a
Oh,
That last song, you cannot not love a record that ends with a Willy Wonka song.
Yay!
Anthony Newley and Leslie Berkus.
Such a great song.
Flipping the script a little bit, because it's a temper tantrum in the movie, and Veruca Salt meets her demise.
Yes.
But here, this seems to be an expression of everything.
It's a celebration.
There's a reason it's the last song on the record.
Yes. Yeah. Well, whew, that's just such an amazing song.
It is.
Oh, my God. When I was writing this arrangement, I would check in with the original recording. The arrangement is crazy. Like, when you're a kid, you don't notice it because you just watch the movie. It's so creative and freaky, the original song. I love it.
Well, that is a psychedelic rock album.
It's totally psychedelic rock.
I want a party with roomfuls of laughter, 10,000 tons of ice cream. And if I don't get the things I am after, I'm going to scream.
So, okay, why is that song the last song on the record? Mainly because I identify with the message of that song. And I say, hell yeah, I want it now. Like, there's nothing wrong with wanting the world. That we're kids. We're supposed to want the world. That's what they tell us we can have. The tricky thing in the end of that movie is that she's only, 11? And she's already a product of her environment. Mm-hmm. But somehow she gets all the blame. Like, that is so crappy and so typical. Like, we scapegoat the product. So she gets dumped down as like a bad egg. But she was trained to be like that. Because of course kids want the world. She's 10 or 11. Mm-hmm. Like, how come she's the bad egg? Like, there's the basic sentiment of I want the world is good. Like, yes, you should feel that. It just, I think it got twisted. Like, unfortunately, it was focused on the wrong kind of how to get that. She was
well,
taught,
it's the selfishness, right? I want to lock it all up in my pocket.
That. So
right?
I want
the world, but I don't want you to have
it.
That's
right. I changed the lyric to I do want to share it.
Yes.
Because I do want it, and I do want to lock it up in my pocket. That's fine. Some of it's for me, and some of it's for you. Mm-hmm. We live in a consumer culture. We're supposed to want it all. So then what? Like, what do you do when you have it all? Share it. Okay?
Well, there you go. You got to share half the Wonka bar.
Yeah, you have a party, rooms full of laughter, 1,000 tons of ice cream, nothing wrong with that. Just share it.
I want the world. I want the whole world. Give it to me.
After a short break, Esperanza Spalding tells us about her experiences as a woman in a male-dominated field. And later, we'll reflect on David Bowie's legacy a year after his death. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.